have three presentations that we're going to be hearing this morning. And first of all, we're going to hear from State Auditor Rebecca Otto. So if Auditor Otto would come forward, and we will begin with her presentation. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. I'm Rebecca Otto, the Minnesota State Auditor, and I'm very pleased to be in front of you this morning to present our budget. I'm going to go ahead and proceed, and I think the Chair said if you have questions along the way, we'll just take them as we go. Okay? All right. So today what I'm doing is presenting my proposed budget for the 12-13 biennium. The goals, I know many of you are new, some of you are returning, and so I want to make sure you understand the office. We provide oversight for over $40 billion in taxpayer money for the biennium. And this is spent by local government, not state government. Our goal is to continue to innovate with a focus on efficiency, not only for our office, but local governments, the public, and we're also always working to increase transparency. We do this through auditing, investigating, reporting, and educating. So the office overview, I'm a constitutional officer. I serve in the executive branch, but I'm not appointed. I'm elected statewide. I serve a four-year term. This is my second term, so I'm in my fifth year. I serve on six state boards, two of them being in the Constitution. I also chair the Collaborative Governance Council, and I serve on the Council on Local Results and Innovation. Those don't have any funding and no staff. I also manage the Office of the State Auditor. We, as an office, receive the National Excellence and Accountability Award from the National State Auditors Association, for which I'm very proud. I also serve on the Executive Committee of the National State Auditors Association and was elected by my peers around the country. So the mission is we oversee a lot of money, $20 billion a year spent by local government, or $40 billion for the biennium. And we do this through audits of local government financial statements. We conduct investigations. We provide transparency of local government finances. And then we oversee tax increment finance districts. And we also oversee over 700 Fire Relief Association pension funds and a few police as well. So every year, there's a lot of information here. Let me know if you have questions. We complete about 150 financial and compliance audits. We review approximately 600 single audit reports, and we issue the statewide single audit report. This is really sexy stuff. We conduct request and petition audits as needed. Taxpayers can actually execute a petition, and if they do it properly and it's certified by the county auditor, we go in and conduct the audit, because we don't do all the audits, but we have seen more activity in the petition audit arena. We handle over 1,000 inquiries from the public and local officials regarding local government financial matters. We handle over 100 special investigative matters related to allegations of wrongdoing in local government. We also collect, analyze, and publish financial data from over 3,300 local governments. We also review investment reports from the 730 public pension plans. We certify, you didn't need me? Okay, I thought you were talking to me. Sorry. We also certify relief associations for police and fire state aid. We oversee over 2,000 tax increment financing districts. We published annual reports on over 3,000 units of local government. And also something important to note, we certify cities for local government aids. And the certification for both the reliefs and the cities occurs when they've jumped through all the hoops that they have to. Had their audits conducted, reported their information, and done business properly. So that's one of the things you have built in terms of, you know, maybe a carrot and a stick type thing. I also convene the annual Volunteer Firefighter Relief Working Group. We've done a lot of good work with that group. So I'm going to start with special investigations and fraud investigations. That division, if you have an org chart, there's about 2.5 people there. we conduct fraud investigations up to 4,300 units of local government, so it's a very large group. And we provide specialized forensic auditing techniques. We can determine the scope of loss, which allows an entity to collect on their bond or insurance, and also to seek restitution so we can get those taxpayer dollars back where they belong. We also provide recommendations to improve their internal controls so that we can reduce the opportunity for fraud. We also work with law enforcement officials when conducting investigations. And we also help private CPAs as well if they need our assistance in conducting investigations. Okay, so outcomes are very important in government. That's something that we focus on as an office. I'm just going to give you there's a whole list of different entities that we did investigations with and the outcomes. Many times there's reports of wrongdoing, but there isn't always something there. So these are some of the ones that there was something there. And they're from around the state, so you might recognize some of the communities. In Atkinson Township, it was $670, and the supervisor was charged with 3 felony counts of theft by swindle. The important thing is when my staff does really good work in terms of putting together the financials and the issues and we forward it to the county attorney, they can prosecute. But getting people charged is a big deal, so our staff does excellent work because a lot of this is charged. There was almost $3,000 with the Fire Relief Association. That was pension funds. City of Henning, the utility billing clerk was convicted of felony theft by swindle. She went 30 days in jail and restitution of the amount that was taken. And so we can keep going through. There was almost $30,000 in Aiken County. Restitution was ordered, as well as jail time and home monitoring. Coochajing Economic Development Authority was $341,000 roughly. This person as well, they were sentenced to a year in jail, and they had a civil judgment. And a matching amount and community service was required. Martin County is one of the most recent. County commissioners charged with 7 counts of felony theft and 1 count of financial transaction card fraud. That case is still in the courts. And St. Paul Public Schools, you may have heard about this about a year ago. The accounting technician was convicted of felony theft by swindle. They were sentenced to jail time, and they were ordered to pay restitution actually above the amount that they took. And sometimes the courts will do that for fees and different things like that. There's more. Norman County East, $64,000 roughly. Conviction, jail time, restitution. City of Mapleview, that's a smaller community. It was state fire aid that was not transferred to the fire relief. Again, this is pension money that you all allocate, and it has to go to the relief to pay. CTC, which we're going to have legislative, we have legislative recommendations for, we're drafting legislation. It was an alternative contract education program, and we've made recommendations for changes, but that involved $18 million. The county attorney decided not to prosecute, but the report is on our website, and it's really not a good situation, so we really believe laws can be tightened to avoid that in the future.
Auditor Otto, yes. Representative Benson has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Governor Otto, and thank you, Chairman.
Governor Otto?
I'm sorry, yeah.
That's okay.
Troy.
It was a late night.
It was late night. No. actually, never mind. That was a comment that I could keep to myself. The number of cases that you've had is, because I've asked this in another presentation of the folks that are in charge of gambling, are any of these, do you recollect, are they the result of somebody's gambling habit?
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, yes, there's been folks with gambling issues. Gambling issues is a frequent one, but there's also sometimes people have health care issues, you know, health care costs. The issue, too, right now is that in an economic downturn, folks have lost health insurance, their spouse may have lost their job, and you know, what's interesting, when the gas crisis came in and the prices were so high, there were some issues around gas cards, you know, and people using them just to try to get to work so they can pay the bills. I mean, in Minnesota, we really do have good government at the local level, considering the number we have and then the number we have issues with. But there are some situations where this occurs, and gambling can be an issue.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Auditor, the number of investigations you have here must take a few FTEs out of your office to do that, and man hours and cost. Can you give me some idea of what it takes to tabulate and investigate all this as far as man hours, people, and money?
Auditor Otto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. We have about 2.5 FTEs to do this work. It's not a lot, considering the over 4,000 units of local government that we potentially could have to investigate. And so we have 2.5. And what we, could we use more? Sure. But we deal with what we have. We prioritize according to, if someone's currently actively, allegedly in stealing, those go to the top of the list. And if someone's been removed and they're no longer able to continue an activity, they might get bumped down. So it's all about prioritizing our work. Our staff has to determine if there's really something there or not, because we get quite a few reports. We have the public calling in saying, I think something's gone wrong. So it's really a matter of our staff working hard, and they're so good. But working hard to prioritize accordingly, and we're dealing with 2.5 FDEs.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a backlog of complaints in this area from different government townships, city, county, whatever, as far as complaints and things that you've not been able to get to, or what is your process?
Okay. Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, we actually track our work, and we track, cases we open each month, cases we close each month. We track things we're monitoring, because sometimes things stay open just because there may be questions, so we monitor. And there's, I'll show you in a little bit here, but the work is there. I mean, we could use more staff, not less. And so, but I'm not going to come and ask you for more staff today. Because we're in such tight times, I would love more staff in that division. But we're really trying to work with what we have. And so what we do is we work to actively, work the cases, find the ones that are, actually there's something there. Sometimes there's nothing there. But when you have the number of people you have, and so you do the best you can. But sure, there's some things that are still open. I wouldn't say the staff has been able to get through some other things. When we have a major investigation that comes in, CTC was a major investigation, the Centers for Training, whatever they are, and so that took full time, several people, all hands on deck. It was a very difficult case. There wasn't really anybody that was willing to take it, and we thought it's really our responsibility to do this for the taxpayers. There's situations where we go in where no one else would have touched it. We really feel that it's important for taxpayers for us to be there, so that we have good government. We don't have everything closed every day. It's not possible with the staffing.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Here's the slide I was talking about. So there's something interesting. The way you have the system built right now is that we don't have enough staff to oversee all of those local governments. And so part of our system, because we have about 110, 115 people roughly to oversee thousands of units of local government. And so you all built in statute 609.456 subdivision 1, a requirement that when a public employee or officer of a political subdivision, which is basically local government, who discovers evidence of theft, of embezzlement, unlawful use of public funds or property, or misuse of public funds, must report the alleged incident to our office. We call them 609 reports. And I just wanted to illustrate to you what's happened over the last several years. The number of 609 reports that we've received, it started at 34 when I first came into office. It went up to 64, then 54, then 68 last year, so it's climbing again. This is very typical in an economic downturn, just so you know. Typically, you need more oversight, not less, just because local governments are having to cut staff and they're losing some of the redundancy that they need. The really interesting thing, business is really, really good right now. As of the 27th, we had 18 so far this year, and we're only into the first 2 months of the year. It's a very rigorous pace. So, Representative Anderson, again, you can see that there's a lot of activity right now. So, one of the things I really believe in is being proactive and preventative with local governments. If we can help them avoid the issues, help them avoid people taking money, we're in much better shape. We want good government. So we do training. We train local government staff. We train private CPAs, over 200 in 2010. The Minnesota Society of CPAs utilizes our staff to do some of that training for auditing of government. We train local government finance staff. We had 627 that were trained in fraud prevention, which is very important. And the good news is, when we do these trainings, people are thrilled, and we wish we had more folks to do training, but we have to keep those folks investigating. We have financial software that the towns and small cities use. It's called CTAS. We trained over 400 local government officials in the use of that. We're getting more and more local governments on the computer so they can report online, so it's wonderful. We trained over 100 local government officials in legal compliance training, again, for auditing, working in government and around governmental accounting in 2010. We are all about innovation in my office. We need to cut down on windshield time. You know, I have a limited staff and there's more work. And so we're doing online trainings both to save local governments money and to save my staff windshield time. Everybody appreciates it. So we've implemented those for the pension, TIF, and GID divisions. Local governments love it. And people said, well, the towns might not use it, especially in greater Minnesota. They love it. They really do. And if they don't have internet connection, they can usually go to the public library to access that, and the librarians are happy to help them. Okay, so if there aren't any questions, yep.
Representative Murphy has a question.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Auditor Otto, every once in a while we get a note from your department or a memo from your department or a notification that one of our townships or one of our cities or one of our isn't in compliance with something or have not submitted a report. Mm-hmm. Are we supposed to do something with that?
Okay.
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that's a wonderful question. So since I've been in office, what we do is local governments have to report to us on an annual basis, and we take that information, we analyze it, and then we make sure the public can get, you know, can see it. We give you guys reports. House Research uses it for information for your committees. The Census Bureau uses it when they do the census. So anyway, what I've done is when we have folks that aren't reporting and they're required, we remind them. We remind them again. And then if they're not going to get their aid, if they're going to cut off, whether it be fire state aid, local government aid, whatever it is, we let you all know as lawmakers. And if those entities have said to you, well, we're getting killed here, you know, we can't afford, well, call them up and say, you're getting killed. Do you want to lose your aid? And so, yes, if you can assist us in that process, sometimes a call from the lawmaker makes all the difference in the world. Because you care about your communities, and we want good government, and we want to make sure people are complying. So that's why you receive those letters. Thank you for asking.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. So our office, I'm very, very proud of. I think we're one of the leanest. I know there's other entities in the room, but I think we're one of the leanest state government offices. And almost 90% of our budget is people. We're people. Our costs are very low in the other areas. I don't issue paper reports anymore except if they're requested. It used to be lots and lots went out. We don't do that. Communication costs are down. Professional and technical is less than 1%. Facilities in repair is 4.4. Travel, very low. We're a very, very lean office. So it's people. So for our proposed 12-13 budget, where the money is spent, I think graphics are good. So the majority goes to audit practice, which is almost 70%. Okay, so the majority of our office is audit practice. We have TIF, Tax Increment Finance. You'll see Job Z at zero. Constitutional Office 2.7, Pension 4.5, GID 5.4, Legal SI 5.3, and OPM, which is technology, accounting, it's lots of stuff. That's 8.2. Next page. So our proposed budget. What I wanted you all to understand is that we have very little impact on the general fund as an office. We request that you make an appropriation. So you appropriate money to our office, but when we do our work, when we conduct our audits, we charge the entities. We're required in statute to recover our costs, nothing above or below, but to recover our costs of auditing. And then we take the fees, we put them right back into the general fund. Okay? And so if you look at it, there's a violet and then a light blue. The TIF, there's a statutory appropriation, which is collected when TIF districts are created. And so that's a special pot of money. And so the impact we have on the general fund is actually that purple slice. Hopefully nobody's colorblind. My son would have a hard time with this graphic. But about 17.2% of our budget actually has an impact on the general fund where it is not recovered through fees or reimbursements or offsets. Okay. So now I'm going to do the dollar amount for you. The portion that is not recovered through fees and reimbursements is a little over $3 million. The rest of it is it's covered. Okay. So the governor proposed a budget for our office. Governor Dayton is taking the same approach as Governor Pawlenty did. governors usually don't weigh in on other constitutional officers' budgets, and so they just kind of keep you flat. Because as constitutional officers, we are elected as well by the people. And it's our job to come to the legislature and to the governor and tell you what we need in order to get our work done. When we put together our budget, the focus always is fulfill the constitutional and statutory responsibilities of the office. We have to ensure transparency and accountability of local government finances for taxpayers and minimize the impact on the state's general fund, as we're very sensitive to the budget situation currently. And I know it's very difficult right now. Our budget is based on the 2011 appropriation. We had four change items. We're not going to pursue two of them, but there are two we are pursuing. The two are our staff retention change item and the elimination of our oversight of JOBSY. There's two change items I'm not pursuing today, which I wanted to bring to your attention. Representative Downey's not here, but Representative Downey was part of helping us last year with a bill that gave us one-time appropriation to make sure that we could do proper oversight of the stimulus funds coming in. There was a lot of taxpayer money that went into that, and taxpayers were very concerned this better be used well, and this better not be misused. So the president said there's a greater level of accountability and transparency than ever with stimulus funds, and we as an office said we have to make sure that we can respond in a timely manner to Representative Anderson if there was misuse of stimulus funds, because we have a very heavy workload, and also we weren't sure what the extra auditing time would require. I was going to ask, we still have, oh, there he is. We still have, I was just talking about stimulus funds, Representative Downey, and the oversight of them. We still have money left over. We're a very, very conservative office by nature, very careful with every dollar that comes in. And we have money left over right now for both the special investigation stimulus money and the audit practice stimulus money that you gave us. I was going to ask that we be allowed to carry it forward. I understand the situation is very difficult, and we are going to try to do without it. Okay? So I'm not asking for them. Our proposed budget is as follows. I don't want to read all the numbers to you, but we start with our base budget. You put in the two change items. We're on page 23 right now. One being a positive, one being a negative, and our proposed budget is $20,156,000, bottom line. Oops. Okay. If we do it by division, this is our proposed 12-13 budget. That shows you by division. Remember, audit practice is about 70% of our operation. And then, and Representative Anderson, you said, well, how many people do you have in your legal SI? You know, we have the SI people that are about 2.5, and then we have some attorneys as well that are very critical to our work. The people that report all those numbers, compile them, analyze them for the thousands of units of local government, that's Government Information Division. We have very small divisions. There's not a lot of people in them. And you see JOBSY zeroed out. All right. This next one, I think, is really useful.
Representative Benson has a question.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you explain, help to for me, clarify for me at least, when I'm looking at the state auditor's staff retention line, $332,012 and $477 in 13. What does that reflect? Why that's a sizable jump. 145,000 difference would be just about 40%, 45%.
Auditor Otto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Benson. It reflects insurance costs and step increases.
Step increases. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Step increases. So you have automatic step increases? Or is...
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, MMB tells us the assumptions to use when we put together our budgets. We're all using the same assumptions. And so I'm not special from anybody else. We do what we're allowed to do based on what the legislature does and based on what MMB... It's very complicated, but they have a system that we go into and we use their assumptions.
Okay.
Representative Benson?
So to be clear, though, I'm looking at that as a pay raise of some sort. And when I talk about state auditors' staff retention, and when I look at that number, I'd like to see a breakout between, what part of that is insurance But what part of that is an increase in pay? Because that is significant. That's 40-45%.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Auditor Roth.
I was. Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, the numbers don't always look exactly the same from year to year for divisions, because that's not the nature of necessarily how the offices work. That's just the way it is. But, I mean, we can certainly work on trying to break something out for you. But it's MMB might be better at explaining some of this stuff to you all in terms of the assumptions we adopt. If the legislature does something differently, then things change. But this is what we were told to use.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand that this might be what they told you to use, but if I was the head of this area, I would certainly want to make sure that I understood the elements that you're going to show this body today well enough so that you could actually define what a 45% increase is. So I would appreciate, I like the fact that the MMB gives you this data, but I do want to follow up so that I know exactly what the difference is. Thank you.
Representative Downey.
Okay.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Auditor Otto. So just to follow up on Representative Benson's question, so that staff retention line, that's exclusively the increase in wages and benefits, overall compensation, is that?
Thank you.
Auditor Otto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Downey. This is to keep my staff. This is to hold on to the people that I have so I don't have to cut staff so we can actually get our work done.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Auditor Otto. So the existing collective bargaining agreements expire on June 30, and my understanding is they haven't been renegotiated yet. So these are MMB assumptions. There's nothing that binds us to these numbers from a collective bargaining, from a current agreement standpoint.
Auditor Otto?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
As long as we have a break here in the presentation, wondering, Auditor Otto, if you could talk a little bit about the history or trend line on the fees that are charged local governments. Have those fees been increasing, being held about the same over time?
Mr. Chair, members, we know what's really great is this year we were able to hold the line at 0% increase on auditing fees. The year before we had a 0% increase on auditing fees. We're very, very careful in my office in terms of being sensitive to local government's financial situation as well. So we do everything we can in terms of efficiency and cutting down on windshield time for the auditors and so that local governments can control their costs. But, yeah, we've been able to hold them flat for a couple of years, and before that... about between 2-3%. I think 1 year was 1%. So we're really, I'm proud of the staff in terms of being able to keep our costs down for local governments.
Wondering if you could provide us, don't expect you to have it here with you today, but the trend line, say the last 10 years as to what's happened to those fees. You must have that record in your... I would expect you'd have that readily available, so I appreciate it if you could get that to us.
Okay. My pleasure, Mr. Chair.
And then you may finish up. We've just got a couple minutes to go, so...
Okay, here we go. All right. That was by division, and then this bar graph, again, illustrates the dark blue is where we collect fees and reimbursements by divisions. This is a slightly different way of looking at it. And the Constitutional Office does not collect fees and reimbursements. OPM, there's a little bit that isn't covered. Pension has a small portion that's not covered. Government information, where we collect all the financial information, analyze it, and publish it for transparency, is not covered. And legal SI is not covered by fees or reimbursements. Okay. Again, we are people, 90% of our budget. The people do the work. And so our change item for staff retention, we have highly trained, sought-after, specialized staff to carry out our constitutional and statutory responsibilities. In a downturn, unfortunately, we're more needed, not less. We really need to keep the staff that we have to continue the critical work that the public expects. So here's the bottom line, and Representative Benson, I think you'll be interested in this. So for staff retention, the net change to the general fund in terms of the impact is 0.1%. or $19,000 for the biennium. And almost all of it is covered by recovered by offsets. JobZ is no longer administered at the local level. It's administered at the state level. It's a state program. We don't oversee state programs. We do local government. Legislative auditor does state programs, and so therefore, and I've talked to him before about this, that it should be transferred to his purview because it's not our area. We don't normally go into state agencies. So moving JobZ out of our office, there's a savings to the general fund of 0.9%. So when you combine the two change items, the impact on the general fund actually is somewhat positive. So to keep our staff, there's really not a cost to the general fund. We need the appropriation, but we put the money back in. So I hope that we can continue to provide strong oversight for the public. There are folks out there that would really like us to do much more. They would like us to publish every check ever written by local government. There's quite a cost to that. And we wouldn't be able to do that at this time, but I would entertain any questions that you have. Thank you.
Auditor Otto, the on page 28, or the where you show the staff retention change item, I thought I understood you to say that you're not going to increase the fees, and yet this shows that there would be an increase in fee income to offset.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'll have the gentleman from my office explain.
Yeah, please identify yourself for the record.
Chair, my name is Matt Lindemann. I'm the Budget, Finance, and Technology Director for the State Auditor's Office. The increase in audit fees would be a direct relationship to the number of hours billed. So if we don't have the staff, we can't bill the hours. If we do have the staff, we can bill the hours. So it's just a direct relationship to how many billable hours we have.
Okay. Representative Downey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe as compared to asking a bunch of questions, I'll make a statement and allow the two testifiers to comment. So I was going in the same direction. It seems to me that we're actually increasing the fees to local units of government here, and I know in my own, my former firm's line of business, audit fees have been going down substantially. In part because of economic issues and the fact that staff have taken compensation reductions, and also through better use of technology and the ability to automate the audit process, audits in general are becoming much more commoditized and not nearly the labor-intensive activity that they were before. So I, too, would zero in on this change item and question why in the world we're actually increasing our cost of labor at the state, transferring that cost through fees down to local units of government, and why we're not able to realize some of those savings that we're seeing in the private sector audit firms, and if there's some other rationale behind this or some other factors that I'm not thinking about. I'm glad to hear them, but it jumps out at me as well that we're increasing our costs and passing it on to the locals.
Mr. You wish to
yes, please, Mr. Chair, Representative Downey. So this is what this says. If you allow me to keep my people, then with those people there and they continue to do the work they've been doing all along, the fees are collected for them. If I lost them, we would no longer collect fees for them, and you guys would have a hole in your revenue. I know it, you're so this is not about higher billing. This isn't about – this is if you allow to keep those – you let me keep those people and allow them to continue to do the work that they do, that will continue to collect fees from the local governments. It's not an increase in fees. Our fees are flat. It's just the people. It's the billable hours for the people. And because audit division, we collect fees on, and we put it back into the general fund, it's a no different impact to local governments. It's the same. It's just how we account for it in the budget document. Does that make sense?
Representative Downey?
Well, Mr. Chair, it really doesn't make sense. Maybe we can have an offline conversation, but the same number of people doing the same number of audits at higher cost with a higher charge back to the locals, and maybe there's some way that you're accounting for it that I don't understand, but it doesn't add up to me, and it certainly runs counter to what the private sector is doing. And it might even beg the question as to whether or not we start outsourcing a higher percentage of these audits, these local government audits, to the private sector and do a comparison between our ability at the state to do a cost-effective job versus the private sector. I know we went in that direction at one point and then backed off. As a state, it might warrant some discussion this year, too. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We need to be moving on here. Representative Kahn and Benson have a question, and then we're going to move on. Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just entering into this conversation for a minute, a question to the auditor. Don't local units of government have the ability to opt out of your services and choose a private firm?
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, currently in statute, we have some counties that work with private CPA firms, and that was a change in 2003. And every 3 years we review the situation they're in, and at the end of the day, it's up to my staff's professional judgment as to what's in the public's best interest. We can rotate them back in and then let some other off if they request it. They are allowed to request, they can send a letter to our office saying we're interested, and so we deal with those on a regular basis and we use our professional judgment.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, I guess people might be interested in seeing at least some examples of where there's been a request, where it's been allowed, where it's been refused, and so forth. And the other thing is it's going, I guess, in the opposite direction of Representative Downey, but I've been interested in all of these funds, funding more of it with offsets from the work that you do. For example, what you do on pension funds, for example. I've always thought that the pension funds should pay for that. I think we're looking, when you look at the number of funds we have, you're looking at a very tiny proportion of what their budget is that ends up, are we going anywhere in that direction? Have we had any discussions in that way?
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, so I'll go back to the slide here. So currently, the pension division, that blue area is actually fire state aid, so 60% of our staff in pension are paid through fire state aid, and we certify them for it. But we don't collect fees from them. You know, some of them are very, very small. It's over 700. And so they're already trying to pay audit fees, which nobody likes to pay audit fees. It's not, you don't get to do ribbon cutting on it. But it's a necessary part of government. When you have government, you have to have audits. And so anyway, I don't know that they would be receptive to that. But that's up to you.
Well,
also.
Obviously, most, a huge number of, one of the things you've been helping this conversation of getting more of the fire departments at least investing through the state investment board. But I think that consolidation, the idea of what we could do in terms of consolidating some of those accounts. But you also have some very big, there are very big pension funds, of which that statement that a tiny percentage wouldn't make any difference to them is probably true. So I'd like to look at what an offsetting that general fund appropriation for pension oversight would do if we did that, as a percentage.
Did you wish to comment? Representative Benson, and then we're moving on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just a request. I won't turn this into a question. I unfortunately have gotten more confused as we've gone along in terms of whether or not the increase is step increases and an increase in the average salary or the number of people or billable hours. I'm looking at the last graph on page 31, and I see that indeed audit fees are going up about from 332 to 458. So when you include some explanation, please just try to clarify that as much as you can in order to help somebody like me to understand exactly what's going on with those numbers.
Yeah.
Is it cost per hour, number of people, and the fee change? If you could, please. Thank you.
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair, I did an org chart for you all, and it's shaded, and it's got a key and everything. So let's just say, and I've actually got it on the computer, but I want to save time and not try to pull it up. So on the org chart, you see the positions we have. These are the positions. If we can keep our staff, if we allow us to have our change item, same number of staff, same audit fee rate, it's not changing, same work. The difference is that your costs do go up from year to year. In order to keep your staff, That's what I'm asking for. What this shows is this is the net impact on the general fund. So it would cost money to keep the staff. However, because we collect fees for our audits because we are required to by statute just to cover our costs, and then we put that back into the general fund, the impact for the general fund after we get back the JobZ money actually is good. It's not because we put fees back in, if that makes sense. So this is just keeping the people I have that are on this org chart, doing the same audit fees. And so what this reflects is keeping those people. There is a cost to keep your people if you're held flat.
Just please.
Representative Benson.
I understand that. I'm just questioning 40%. I mean that you know, if we increased the cost of doing business with everybody that's employed at the state at the same level, we'd be broke in 2 years. So please, we don't need to take any more time up. If you just address that in a note, that would be fine. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I clarify? Where are you coming up with 40% so I can understand?
Well,
President Benson.
So it's 332 to 447. Mm-hmm. Staff retention change item. Mm-hmm. So just explain how we get from 332 to 447 and 477.
Okay, we need to move on.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could work with Representative Benson and perhaps Representative Downey offline, I'd be happy to do that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for being here today.
Thank you.
And we are now going to move to the Amateur Sports Commission. And we've allocated 15 minutes, and we're already over by about 10 minutes, so... Welcome, Mr. Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So will I get a few extra points if I get it done in 7 minutes and get you back on time?
Well, tell us what you need to tell us.
All right.
I know you will do it well.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You should have two handouts, one that's four color and another that's black and white, that's really the same in the state budget book. Again, for the record, I'm Paul Erickson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission. I may have a board member, Joel Carlson, join me, but he had another hearing. Starting with this sheet, if I just walk you through this, I know there's a number of new members around the table who have probably not done oversight of the Amateur Sports Commission. I think these charts really tell the story. Unbelievable. One of the prime goals of the Amateur Sports Commission is to oversee the National Sports Center in Blaine. And just for point of reference, the Sports Center in Blaine is the state's most visited sports facility, more than the Metrodome, more than Target Field, more than XL. We have 4 million visitors a year. The 11 facilities that you as the legislature have funded since 1987 produce $70 million of out-of-state spending that's brought into Minnesota. These 12 facilities have 9 million annual visitors, of which 4 million occur at the Sports Center in Blaine. And we also direct the Star of the North Games, which has up to 5,000-6,000 athletes. And a number of you around the room have had Star of the North Games in your community, like Moorhead and Rochester and so on. Looking at the next page, this is a very simple agency for you to oversee and evaluate. We have 3 staff at the bottom, myself, an associate director, and a fiscal person. Our 3 goals have remained the same since our inception: to create economic development through amateur sports. And just to quickly net that out, we basically create, we build facilities and create events. If there is a volleyball tournament in Rochester, there's 100 teams and 50 come from outside Minnesota. The spending that they bring to Minnesota is a real value and economic benefit for Minnesota. The second thing we do try to create more opportunities. When we build these facilities, many Minnesotans get great experiences, and then we also would like to be a national model. Several of our facilities have national team training. The facility in Blaine is home to the U.S. Olympic women's hockey team. Several national teams train in volleyball in Rochester and so on, and you'll see the chart. Now, the third page is a green chart. I think this is very enlightening. You can see in our history, our state general fund appropriation was as... high as $600,000 a year, but it's been very flat and going down recently. And I want to give you some fun facts about this. Our board used to meet monthly. They now meet quarterly. We have board members who do not take per diem in order to help us make budget. In order to maintain our current three FTEs, we made an appeal to Hennepin County, and we administer the Twins Legacy Grant Fund. That brings in $65,000 total, but about $40,000 net to the Amateur Sports Commission, so we can maintain our three staff. Without that, we would be down to two FTEs, which would be very awkward to maintain the agency. My trip here today will not be submitted, because I rarely submit any expense reports for mileage or travel because we don't have the budget. And our three staff, the previous person talked about step increases. I think the record is for like the last 5 or 6 years, our three staff have had no step increases in order to maintain budget. So it's a very austere operation, but we managed to maintain this statewide network of economic benefit for the state. The next page, just you can see the facilities that have been funded by the legislature over the years, and then you can see the attendance at those facilities tends to grow. One positive note in this presentation, what we have found is that amateur sports participation is somewhat recession resilient. People still invest in their kids, and the budgets for most of our facilities have maintained fairly constant because you can ask yourselves, if you've got a son or daughter, you may postpone buying a new car in a recession, but are you going to take Johnny or Susie out of figure skating or hockey? Probably not. So we're and people still travel from other states. The next page is the economic impact from these facilities. You know, it stopped going up. I think there's two theories for that. One is that when our agency was cut back, we don't do a lot of new event development. We're just maintaining current facilities, and the recession probably has an impact. The next sheet is Star of the North Games. You'll see the history of where the games have been. This coming year, it'll be in 2011 in St. Cloud. And then the next sheet, where it has some dollar bills, I think this is a very good graph for all of you. If you take the $70 million that comes in Minnesota every year through these facilities around the state, and you take the sales tax on that, it would generate about $4.3 million. I asked the Department of Finance, or now OMB, that the mortgage payments or your principal and interest on the facilities that you have funded cost Minnesota about $3.8 million. The net benefit for Minnesota is the $66 million that goes to all the hotels, restaurants, and businesses. And there's actually about a $500,000 a year surplus to the state. So if we could collect our own sales tax from our activity, I wouldn't be here today, because we would have enough funds to fund the agency. But obviously that goes into the general revenue of the state. But just to let everyone know that your investment in this entire activity has paid off. And then the final page with the two slides just show the Sports Center in Blaine continues to grow. It does not receive a city, county, or state direct subsidy. And then you'll see the economic impact that comes from the Sports Center. And then the next handout is basically, Mr. Chairman, right out of your budget documents, where it shows the pie chart of how the dollars spend and more background on the agency. With that, I would be open to questions.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Erickson, good to see you again.
Nice to see you again.
I just wanted to ask a question. I don't know if it was in this committee. I know it was certainly in the Health Committee that the governor proposed a fee on hockey arenas for indoor air quality. We kind of went around with this last year, and I just wanted to get your sense of how you think this is going to impact your facilities, if not other hockey arenas around the state.
Mr. Erickson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, and I'd like to special appreciation. Representative Hayden served on the board of the Amateur Sports Commission. That is not related to our budget, but relates to the National Sports Center. Since the National Sports Center has eight ice arenas under one roof, the largest in the world, the proposed fee is $900 per sheet per year. that would hit the National Sports Center's budget of $7,200 a year. We believe that's excessive. And I know that the fee proposed is to cover more inspectors to inspect these arenas. Our facilities have never had an infraction or a problem with air quality. So to pay a, you know, $7,200 annual premium for a facility that has no infractions, I think is a little much. We're recommending through the process that there should be a per facility fee, not a per sheet fee, and it should be reduced for everyone.
Representative Hayden.
Mr. Chair, as a follow-up, so we think that it may make sense for us to do more inspections on facilities throughout the state. You just think that because you have so many ice sheets in your facility that it disproportionately hits you harder? Is that what you're saying, Mr. Erickson?
Mr. Erickson?
Representative Hayden, Mr. Chairman, I would say two things. One, that multiple sheets are hit too hard, and that the fee itself is a little high. I think the job could be done effectively for a lesser fee for everyone as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, on page 3, you cite different facilities that are funded. One just sort of pops off the page. I just like to understand Giants Ridge Golf and Ski Resort up in the Wabik. What kind of funding comes through your organization? Because they're, yeah, if you could answer that, that'd be helpful.
Yeah.
Mr. Erickson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. Our agency does not fund any operating dollars, but over the course of the years, we have funded one-time capital improvements, and I can get you the, I don't have it right in front of me, it's been like almost 10 years since we gave a capital fund appropriation to Giants Ridge, but I think at the time it was for their biathlon and their cross-country ski facilities, not the golf facility and not the downhill ski facility.
Thank you.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The actually same page, the one that caught my eye was not Giants Ridge, but the U of M Aquatic Center. And I wondered if you could explain why there's one U of M facility in there.
Mr. Erickson.
Representative Winkler and Mr. Chairman, that's a really good question because in 1987, the state was interested in hosting the U.S. Olympic Sports Festival. At the time, the university was proposing a new pool. And the governor asked the university, what would it take to make the facility a good facility to a national class that could host national Olympic events? And the rough numbers was the University of Minnesota was prepared to spend like 18 or 19 million, and so that the governor added $3 million through the Amateur Sports Commission to rise the standard of the facility. But it's primarily, it's a university facility. And then in order to receive those funds, the university had to accept the mission of hosting national amateur sport and Olympic events, which they've done a good job at since that facility was built in 1989.
Representative Winkler.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess the question is how long, so as long as the U Aquatic Center takes on that obligation, they receive the funds. And then I guess my follow-up question is that the only facility at the university that actually provides that service?
Mr. Erickson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, other facilities at the University of Minnesota do host non-university events on an occasion, but I think the Aquatic Center has been true to the agreement that in exchange for receiving the $3 million that they assumed an obligation to host national swimming and diving events, and they generally hosted one or two of those every year since the appropriation was made.
Finally, Mr. Chair, is there an ongoing payment that the university receives for this, or is this a single one-time payment, and since that time they've continued to provide the access?
Mr. Erickson.
Mr. Chairman, the latter is correct. They received a $3 million capital fund appropriation in 1987, and they received no funds to the Amateur Sports Commission since that time. And they continue the obligation for the life of the facility.
Thank you.
We have three more members, and then we need to move on. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me, Mr. Erickson. Going back to the question on fees for the ice sheets. In rural Minnesota, there are a lot of arenas that might have two ice sheets, and you know, the thought that one inspection per site should suffice, I think we should look at. I've had other, you know, like concession stands, two on a football field where they were charging for each, and we managed it through legislation last year to have one inspection per site. How long does it take them, on the average, do you think, to inspect one ice sheet?
Mr. Erickson?
Mr. Chairman, I have to admit, I personally haven't been in the arenas when inspectors have come. And I think, to Representative Hayden's credit, historically they haven't come often enough. But I think when they do come, it's a two-hour, I would estimate. And our arenas have, monitoring on the wall of each sheet, and so they come in and check the current reading, and then there's a log that's kept by our managers, which they also refer to. So they do both a, you know, one-time inspection of air quality, and then they check the log for previous.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Erickson. How many people come out to inspect?
Mr. Erickson?
Historically, Representative Erdahl, Mr. Chairman, one person.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Erdahl.
Well, $900 for a few hours or a couple hours for one person does seem a little bit excessive. I think it's something that should be looked at.
Representative McElfatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Erickson, I would like to know if the indoor rifle training center just north of Grand Rapids had fallen under your authority until about 2-3 years ago.
Mr. Erickson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's a really good question, and I've never had the opportunity to give our agency position on that for the legislature, and I'm probably going to take some people out, but I'll give it to you now. Going back when that appropriation came before the legislature, it was given to our agency, not at our request. We evaluated and we concluded that it would be not feasible financially to operate. And so we sent it back to Governor Carlson saying our agency determined this project is a bad idea and it would be not feasible to be located in Grand Rapids because it's a rural area, the population couldn't support it. Governor's office decided they wanted it anyway. They issued an executive order to transfer the authority to the DNR. The DNR went and built it, and lo and behold, years later, they found they could not manage it financially. They closed it, and it's been in mothballs, to my understanding. And the only thing, I talked to a DNR official about 2 months ago, I said they were considering making a DNR office space. But that's the sad case of that project.
Further question? Michael Packard?
Just clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Erickson, so it has never fallen under your authority?
Mr. Erickson?
Representative, Mr. Chairman, I'm glad to say it has never been under our authority.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Slawick, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Erickson, I saw that a number of events when the Metrodome roof fell had been moved to the National Sports Center in Blaine. I mean, do you expect the income to go up there quite a bit this year because of that event?
Mr. Erickson?
Representative, Mr. Chairman, this is one of the most interesting hearing for really interesting questions that relate to our world. We were hopeful that there would be more events, but most of the events for the Metrodome were baseball-related and ones that required that large space. We were fortunate to have Twins Fest, which was a very positive event, and I think 20,000 people visited the National Sports Center in those 3 days, and it was, you know, positive economically for the Sports Center. But that is the only event that we've been able to inherit from the misfortune of the Metrodome's fallen roof.
Thank you.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Erickson, for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How'd I do for time?
You did very well. You get a gold star. Representative Murphy, did you have a...
Mr. Chair, Mr. Erickson, who got the baseball games then?
Twins. Some of them.
I think a lot of different... Mr. Erickson?
I don't know.
Okay. All right, we're going to move now to the Office of Enterprise Technology. Commissioner Parnell. Welcome. Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, good morning. My name is Carolyn Parnell. I'm the CIO for the state of Minnesota and the Commissioner of the Office of Enterprise Technology. I'm happy to be here to give you an overview of OET's budget and budget process. I feel a little like I'm entering the freeway with a learner's permit, since I have not been here very long, but I am very familiar with the funding model that OET uses. I have some expertise at hand, and I'm happy to go back and get answers to any questions that I cannot answer readily. So I'll just give you a little sense of OET. Very brief. I know that there were members of the OET leadership team that were here 2-3 weeks ago that gave you an agency overview. I can tell you that the Office of Enterprise Technology, in spite of having employees who have been working in IT for the state for upwards of 30 years, it's a relatively new organization. It was put in place about 5 or 6 years ago with, I believe, the intention to consolidate some decentralized IT organizations in the interest of efficiency and more transparency. Clearly, the goal in that is to improve government through the effective use of information technology. I would say that we have a sort of quasi-captive audience in terms of our customers. The executive branch is obligated to use many of our services, although we also have other government entities such as counties, municipalities, etc., who are who come to us and want to use our services. So we do have a reputation, I believe, by virtue of people asking for our services of being a leader in enterprise information technology in the state of Minnesota. Basically, we're responsible for two major items. Governance and oversight are designed to fulfill our statutory obligations. We are charged with being the leaders for IT in the state of Minnesota by setting policy standards, planning for the future of the enterprise in terms of technology. We are responsible for security, which is a role that we take very, very seriously. That is something I will talk about a little bit later. Our security is largely funded out of the general fund. And again, we're required to make sure that there is compliance and standards in place. And that, I believe, has been a very successful undertaking. There have been centralization efforts towards procurement, standard setting, et cetera, that have saved a great deal of money for the state of Minnesota. Again, we have some utility services that our agencies in the executive branch are required to use. We have a very robust network that connects many, many sites around the state. And again, there are some agencies who are not required to use our services who come to us because we do offer value for our services and are able to provide it to them in a very cost-efficient way. Just to give you a sense, 5% of our budget comes from the general fund. The rest of it is pretty much totally revenue-based. And there is a special revenue fund, which I will also speak to a little bit later. Our total employment has been going up. I sort of attribute that to partly to the centralization and partly to the need for added security. The security office and program has been growing over time, but it's only about 4 years old. As we've been ramping up to make sure that we fulfill all of the commitments related to security, we have added staff there. There have also been some additions in terms of financial analysis. We have a large budget, and we need to make sure that the monies are spent wisely and that our charges are relevant and appropriate and accurate. So our general fund expenses basically fall into two areas. One is the Office of the State, CIO, and I spoke to this a little bit. It allows us to fulfill our statutory requirements. We have oversight of IT projects. We have program management and planning. We have an architecture design that has been established over the last few years that really looks out into the future of IT and makes sure that we can make progress technologically and in efficiency as well. Our largest use of general funds is for security, and I cannot underestimate, or I should say overestimate, the need for ongoing funding for security. We all read about this topic in the news and hear about it. Attempts to invade our systems are increasing in number. They're increasingly more nefarious. They're increasingly sophisticated, and they are international in nature. So there's a lot of activity that goes into, I guess what I would say, helping me to sleep easier at night. There's an awful lot of security issues that exist in our world today, and it's important that we keep funding that initiative. It's actually based on best practice and some comparative studies with other states and federal entities underfunded, but we understand that these are critical times, and we can do the very basic things that we need to do given the funding that we've asked for. You can see that our expenditures have been going down, our budget has been going down. It doesn't reflect a reducing of importance of these issues, but it, I believe, points to the fact that we recognize what the nature of the current budget crisis is. The governor's budget does propose reductions. What that means for the Office of the CIO is that we'll have to be even a little more careful in how we spend our dollars. And for security, it will cut a position that we have not hired into yet. Of course, any cuts in that budget is a little bit alarming because we can't continue to grow as we need to grow and ramp up to meet the increase in security needs. Under the 970 fund, budget activities, which is the fund that actually consists of the revenues that we get from our chargeback for services, we operate at a break-even rate, and I think that's an area that I am going to dig into a little bit deeper. There are some services that are subsidized. It's very transparent that they are. But I think that we can look at some financial management practices that can sort of get at those kinds of issues. It's not anything that has been secret or hidden. We have started down the path of an activity-based costing methodology, which is something that I believe in strongly and something I think will result in even more accurate rates for our services. We have actually had rate decreases for the last couple of years, and we are not projecting any rate increases for the next couple of years. I attribute that to an increased focus on our financial analysis of what we do and a sort of overall reorg that aligns our functionality with the services that we offer. We do have a very robust collaborative process for setting rates. I was on the other end of this process when I worked at MNSCU. MNSCU takes advantage of OET's network services to connect all of its colleges and universities around the state. And so we were a part of the rate review that occurred every year. It was very transparent. It was very collaborative. I just do not have any concerns at this point about the process for setting those rates. There are a couple of slides coming up that I'm just not going to go into in detail. I think it's enough that you know that rate setting is a very transparent process. It's something that is under some continuous improvement practices, and we will continue that going forward. There are a couple of special revenue accounts that I had some questions about. The information and telecommunications account is an account that agencies have the option of taking advantage of. If they have monies for whatever reason that they think would be advantageous to put into a pool so that we can centralize some of those services, and they can save some money doing so, they have the option of putting that money in that pool, and then we tap that money. An example of that is when we recently centralized all of the disparate email systems into one system managed by the Office of Enterprise Technology, there were agencies that had some money that they could put into this account that sort of eased some of the transition costs that they had in order to move onto this centralized email system. The other account is the statewide electronic licensing system. There is a very current project that is has a business owner at Department of Labor and Industry that OET is a close partner of. They are funded now by fees that are added on to license requests, and that project, I think, is expected to last for about another 5 years, but it is, as I understand it, a different way of doing business and a different way of funding this particular project. So I'm happy to entertain any questions that you might have.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm pretty certain I may have asked this question in a previous meeting when we were talking about enterprise technology, but just a couple of questions. One may be just a request, and can you provide a breakdown by agency of the chargebacks for the last 5 years?
Ms. Parnell?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, absolutely. I do have that information. Okay.
And one other question. I think this is the one I may have asked before. Can agencies elect to use an outside vendor or for services? I guess how much competition is there in terms of they can buy a product as long as it conforms to their specs or standards? If they can buy it outside more cost effectively than they can yours, is that option available?
Commissioner Parnell?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, I believe that's the case. I don't want to answer definitively. I think it's one of the reasons that we try to stay competitive. I will get more information on that. My understanding is that that is the case in a limited kind of way. There are some centralized services that we require agencies to use. Security is one of them.
Sure.
Network is another. But I'll look into that in a little more detail.
Representative
Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a little follow-up then. Could you also then provide the guidelines for agencies to be able to do that?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, absolutely.
Thank you.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. I want to compliment Ms. Parnell for the good job she's doing. She's jumping on a train that's rolling down the tracks pretty fast, and just make members aware that Representative Kahn and I have kind of jointly authored a bill that hopefully will be heard here about even furthering the consolidation, and I think some real cost savings and service improvement opportunities. So we'll be hearing that at some point, I hope. A question, though. I noticed the 0% projected rate decreases in 2012 and 2013 as compared to fairly significant reductions in 10 and 11. And I'm wondering if there's a basis behind that. Are there a certain set of kind of capital investments that you're making or expenses that you're taking on that will then produce rate reductions in the future? Is this just kind of a blip, or is the trend that we saw in 10 and 11 not sustainable? What's behind the 0% as compared to continuing decreases in the rates?
Commissioner Parnell?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, it may be too soon to tell that. I think some of I think there have been projected rate decreases. For example, email is one. There's now a chargeback per email box as a result of the centralization. My understanding is that is going down. We have not really completed our rate review process, which kicks in the spring. So I think that it's too soon to say whether or not those rate reductions will continue, but we're relatively assured at this point that they won't go up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Parnell, you just touched briefly on the statewide electronic licensing system, and that's, and I think that's a superb initiative, first of all. What I'd like to know is where we're at on that system. How many do we have all the licenses now that the state has overview of? Are they online? Can they be purchased online? Where are we at with that system, please?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have had a couple of pilots for licensing. I recall offhand one of them is EMT licensing. The two pilots are with the Department of Human Services. The Department of Labor and Industry is just kicking into their pilot. So it's very early on in the process. There's a very ambitious schedule, though. I agree with you that I think this is a very valuable and e-citizen approach to licensing, but it's in the early days, but on track, as I understand it, at this point. I know that Commissioner Peterson is getting very engaged in this project, very involved, so I expect progress going forward.
Thank you.
Representative Kahn.
Yes. Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Parnell, first of all, comment on Representative Leidinger's comment that the funding for this was actually done as a collaborative process through this division, which came up with the model that was able to do the funding for the development of the system without a new general fund, without using a general fund appropriation. But there are, as Representative Downing said, we're moving forward in a different direction for this agency. But there are a couple of things that are also in place. Have you analyzed, and things that started before you got here, and now I don't know what your position is on it. There's a bonding request that we're looking at as part of the data centralization. What's been your position on that, and what is the department doing about that request?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I am very much behind the consolidation of the data center effort. I would caution anyone who expects it to be a cost-saving undertaking, though. It is more remedial than that, in my opinion. I think in the long run, it will be cost-saving. As we centralize security, we find efficiencies and cost savings, and if we do not have to provide security for many distributed systems but can focus it on one data center, I believe that we're way ahead of the game. I think that the whole approach toward the consolidation of the data centers has not, in essence, relied on that bonding funding. I think that it's recognized as something that has to be completed. If that happens, it will be great. It will be a real plus. But going forward with this project is not absolutely conditional on that funding at this point. And I have every intention of seeing that through. It's been a very collaborative approach. There's a steering committee that consists of constituents and some of the CIOs from the larger organizations, agencies, and it's a very good undertaking.
Then, Mr. Chairman, one of the problems that we saw, I guess, in our preliminary hearings from Department of Finance was the problem with the budget system. And one of the problems that came up with the problems of the budget system was the fact that we have a limit which has been changed, and maybe we should look at changing it back again or put other things than just the size of the item. OET is supposed to have to sign off on projects over a certain size. But something like the budget system, which is so important to the entire state, managed to get exempted from that by the Commissioner of Finance negotiating the costs down, so it was below that size. That I think the number was $10 million, and it went down to $5 million, so it didn't get the OET oversight. How can we deal with this issue of OET oversight of large? I mean, maybe Representative Downey's bill will totally take care of it, but by just putting the projects where they probably belong. But how do we take care until that bill is fully, expect it to pass, but until it's fully implemented, how do we deal with this issue of oversight over really important items that may fall below that threshold, which may be too high? I think there are three lines in that question.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I am somewhat familiar with that project. My guess is that OET, as it has been ramping up and redefining itself, has been tightening up on its ability to have oversight of those kinds of projects. I think it's something that I personally am looking into. It becomes a very serious issue when people come to me and I cannot necessarily account for what that process was. So I am looking into that. I think, a reminder to everyone that this is really a statutory obligation is one piece, but I think another very important piece is what sort of relationships I establish with these agencies, with commissioners and with CIOs and with the IT staff as they undertake a project. I think that if there's a very robust process for review that everyone understands, we'll make great progress in that area.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Well, we haven't had this robust process, and we have a system that's in trouble and that's really important to the state. How do we fill in those blanks?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I believe we're talking about what is called as the BIS system. I have spoken with Commissioner Showalter. There has been a vendor that he is working with in a determination as to whether something should sort of start over or should more money be thrown at this particular effort. I have people at the table in that conversation. I can't yet tell you what the outcome might be. But it is under study, and I am in communication with them about that.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
This is kind of a dopey name. Maybe it needs a classy name and a good logo, like BOSS or something like that. our legal counsel for this this division actually excels at working on acronyms. He's done multiple really good ones.
Representative Kahn, maybe we should have a contest.
Well, we did. They did.
Contest.
We had a couple of things last time. We had a Kahn system and a Betzalt system, but I'm sure we can come up with a Lanning system really fast.
Yeah. Commissioner, any further comment to that?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say I have been responsible for many contests for naming servers.
Oh.
I haven't come up with contests for acronyms, but sounds like not a bad idea.
Representative Stansrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would your organization would also be involved with any projects going on, like in DMV with some of the online services and payments? Is that correct?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Stansrud, yes, I believe that is correct.
Okay. I would just like to follow up with you maybe afterwards. Just got a couple of questions. Thank you.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Stensrud, along those lines, I think you're probably with the HHS or the DHS systems. I mean, there's terrible problems in those systems, and they're antiquated, particularly the eligibility systems are causing problems, and then there's a separate computer technology for the child care system, and then they don't talk to each other, and then we can't track child care waiting lists, and I mean, it just goes on and on like it does in a lot of places. Are you involved in that?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, if they are new and recent projects at a certain dollar level, we are likely to be involved. My understanding is that some of these DHS systems are quite old, and so we would not have oversight in that case. It's also the case that many applications unique to the agencies are pretty managed in totality by those agencies. But I'm happy to have a conversation with you and get more information on specific applications that you're interested in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, Representative Slawick.
I think they talked about they were still working with COBOL, which is like we learned in college, you know, back in a long time ago. So I think they're very antiquated. And the problem is it gets so expensive now to update things. So I would like to have a further conversation.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm happy to have that conversation. I come from a system at MinSCU that was also COBOL-based, and it can be very hardy as a system. One of the downsides is that it's hard to find skill sets now to deal with that. So there are a number of issues there.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, just a quick comment, and welcome the CIO's comments back, but the bill that we've constructed to try and bring more of the IT enterprise under the control of OET really focuses just on the kind of the bottom half of IT infrastructure, more just the servers and the core technologies and not the business applications in the agencies, and I think that's probably a discussion for us to have as a committee, whether it would make sense to even wrap those higher-level business applications under the auspices of OET. Right now, we give them this mandate in statute to provide some kind of quality assurance and some kind of project management checkpoints along the way. Meanwhile, there are these literally, you know, tens of millions of dollars of systems being deployed in these big agencies, and OET really barely has an opportunity to kind of course correct along the way. And we've seen some large failures, and these aren't, I mean, system failures occur all the time in the public and private sector. It's just, you know, a tough thing to manage. But we may want to think about whether we even expand the scope of Representative Kahn's and my bill to lay in those big applications under the purview of OET and allow them to prioritize and manage the portfolio of big expenditures and make sure we're doing them in a systematic and planful way and that they're being controlled and managed the right way too. So it's an important topic and I think a place where we could do a lot better in the state, and a question whether OET is the right place and the right time to put that as well. So if you have a comment,
Commissioner,
welcome that too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, as with your existing bill, I am more than happy to be a part of that conversation and to look for any opportunities for efficiency and collaboration without knowing much further than that.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on Representative Downey's comments, I wonder if part of the challenge we face is also in oversight. The legislature has, you know, because I think Representative Kahn has had a longstanding interest in technology and has been involved in this committee. This committee traditionally has, and OET budget comes through here, has an interest in technology issues. But the Human Services, you know, Health and Human Services Committee doesn't have a particular interest in technology. The education committees don't have a particular interest in the technology of how their departments run. And it just occurs to me that one proposal that Representative Kahn has had is that all technology items come through this committee. Another one could potentially be a joint legislative committee on state technology and do something that is bicameral in nature, because I suspect there aren't, you know, 25 people in the legislature who are interested in this and in both bodies, but maybe if you pool them together, you might get, you know, 15 who actually cared about it and could serve in something of the role of the Pension Commission in developing some expertise and some institutional memory and providing oversight here, which will then guide the other eight divisions and committees that aren't interested. So I don't know if you have the ear of the speaker or anything like that, Representative Downey, but it seems to me that that is something that the legislature could do without having to pass a law and reorganize all of state government first.
Commissioner, did you wish to respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Winkler, again, I'm happy to have some conversation. I'm very open to collaboration and advice and whatever people have to offer me as I sort of ramp up in this position. So I stand open to any of those suggestions.
Representative Downey?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that comment, I think that's a great idea. I would suggest that simply doing the legislative piece of it without doing the kind of structural reorganization within the executive branch would leave us just kind of nibbling around the edges, and the core of it would be within the agencies. But I agree, and we've got a technology advisory committee that would support the CIO within the executive branch to bring the business perspective in support of the CIO within the set of commissioners in the agencies. Pairing that up with some kind of legislative oversight would make all the sense in the world in my mind, but not absent doing it in the executive branch, too. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner, thank you very much for the presentation here today, and thank you for the good conversation that you and I had about what the challenge lies before you. And as I had indicated to you in our conversation, I think it's important for us to make the right investments in terms of our technology and to make sure that we see some results, that we aren't only investing and not knowing what kind of results come out of that. And so we appreciate your attention to making sure that we get some results from the investment that we make. And also, I appreciated your commitment to letting us know when there are problems. We've got some major undertakings that are taking place right now with regard to our accounting system and our budget, and I think it's very important that we stay informed as to whether there are problems or issues and not be surprised along the way. So you have any further comment about those points as we conclude here?
Mr. Chair, I also benefited, I think, from our conversation. I believe that IT in particular, because it's often a big spend item, needs to have a lot of accountability and a lot of transparency and a lot of owning up to issues that come up as they come up. So I just have no objection to sharing information. Tackling those things early on as possible, so that that they're in people's view and we can capture the appropriate brain trust, I guess, is what I would consider it to move forward in a practical and effective way, regardless of what the issue is.
Thank you, Representative Slawick. You had
Mr. Chair. I have a procedural question. So after the commissioner's done, maybe a question about. For you, actually, about the letter I just wanted to, that we had asked for last week to see if we were going to get a copy of that?
Yes. Representative Kahn, I think, has the letter.
Yeah, I thought I had sent it to everyone, or at least the DFL members.
I don't have that, so if I could get a copy of it, I'd appreciate it.
Nora, I have some.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Commissioner, and we'll welcome you back at any time.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Committee.
Members, tomorrow we have the Pepin Bill 174, and the Revenue Department will be bringing forward their budget, so we will have the budget books again, and we're adjourned.